The headlines this hour. Iran's top security official likens the 2015 agreement to an empty shell, ruling out any talks beyond the JCPOA due to Washington's noncompliance and Europe's inaction. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails the role of resistance in confronting threats from Israel, which he calls a racist and apartheid entity. And in the UK, victims of a government-backed Islamophobic purge in Muslim-majority schools renew their demands for justice. We'll have a report from Birmingham. Thanks for joining us. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the U.S. and Europe have failed in fulfilling their obligations regarding the 2015 Iran deal. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said because of such inaction, the deal has already turned into an empty shell for Iran, both in terms of the economic benefits and the removal of sanctions. The top security official said that there will be no negotiations beyond the deal with a non-compliant Washington and a passive Europe. Currently, Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive talks in Vienna. Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions, as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current U.S. administration. It's time now for the news review. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails resistance groups for defending the country in the face of Israel's military attacks and threats over the past decades.
The resistance, with all its factions, including Hezbollah, is the resistance is what preserved the identity of Lebanon, the identity of Lebanon that was going to be erased completely with the invasion of 1982. Every single person who comes and questions the identity of Lebanon today should remember 1982, in the year 2000, in 2006, and until today, it is the resistance that preserved the identity of Lebanon. It preserved it with blood, with sacrifice, with fighting and struggle and jihad, and it continues to preserve it until today.
And God Almighty love him. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was speaking in a ceremony commemorating the martyrs of resistance. He denounced Israel as a racist and apartheid entity, saying that the regime is on the decline. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's military capabilities. He said that the movement has been producing drones in Lebanon and has the ability to turn thousands of rockets into precision-guided missiles. Mariam Saleh, a correspondent joining us from Beirut, will give us an update on highlights of what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has said. Also, Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator, also joining us from Beirut, will give us an analysis on this. All right, Mariam, first over to you. Give us some of the important highlights that you deemed important in your eyes. I'm curious also about many of the statements that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said when it came to Israel.
Yes, definitely. Where Sayyid Nasrallah basically labeled his speech into several different significant parts. And two of those parts were the development of the Israeli entity and how weak it has become. And he said that these are not the words of him as a secretary general of a resistance movement. He said these are the words of the Israeli officials, Israeli thinkers, Israeli researchers, and this is why he gave some examples of how this is one very significant point that we need to look at. We need to look at how such an unnatural, as he called it, he called it an artificial entity that was planted into the region, and that basically what we are looking at is an entity that is going towards the end, towards the decline, and basically total disappearance, and it will cease to exist. And he said that these were dreams perhaps in the past for some, but for now, they are realistic issues based on research, based on studies and things that we are preserving. We are not seeing these from the words, as we said, from the resistance, as we are hearing them from the Israelis on a daily basis. And one very important point he mentioned is that former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that he needs to put so much effort in order to try to let Israel live for 100 years, because no state for the Jews has ever lived longer than 80 years. This is a very important point, but you also have the issue of the strength of the resistance alliance as a whole, and the fact that Syed Hassan Nasrallah, of course, he mentioned that there is a lot of support coming from the Islamic Republic of Iran since day one in 1982, when the resistance was established. But what's happening right now as a result of the so-called battle between wars, the Israelis have called this, we are not in direct confrontation right now. There is not a continuous war, despite the fact that Lebanon and Israel remain technically at war. But what is happening is a battle between wars. It's basically when Israel is targeting the resistance other than Lebanon. They are trying to target the resistance in Syria, trying to stop the transportation and the movement of any arms that's coming in from the Islamic Republic of Iran into Lebanon. And he, ironically, of course, thanked the Israelis because that was a threat that Hezbollah was able to transform into an opportunity with the assistance of experts, whether in Lebanon or in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they were able to transform their rockets into more precise rockets. And they were able to even create and make their own drones here in Lebanon without the need for transportations in many cases. So therefore, he is telling the Israelis that even these wars that you have done, they are worthless. They have done nothing against the resistance.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Mariam Saleh, from Beirut, a correspondent. Let's move. You have what people think about Hezbollah and its strength. But on the other hand, you had what the Hezbollah Secretary General said, which I'm going to go to where he said Israelis know that they're in trouble when, as he mentioned, 40% are migrating out of Israel. You have a problem of social crisis within Israel, which leads one, and my question to you, is whether you think that Israel is rupturing from within and therefore cannot be on the offensive on the outside.
Definitely, this is a manufactured state and is a colony made on fabricated mythology that doesn't even relate to reality. And it's an attempt to create an identity based on ethnic cleansing and genocide of the indigenous people. So the weakness for this artificial construct of both Zionism and the state that represents this ideology is weak as long as the indigenous people of the land, the Palestinians, the Arabs, resist that. Even for if there's only one left Palestinian that is resisting, this fake entity cannot sustain this fake identity. And we see that similarly happening in places like Canada or Australia whenever the indigenous people stand up for their rights, and how weak this fabricated identity of a Canadian colony or the Australian colony, and similarly this Zionist entity. The speech that Sayyid Nasrallah delivered had so many points that are clearly indicators of the collapse of this entity that is coming, and that it is on the decline. The end is almost visible for anyone who wants to really look at it.
Okay, and Mary, my final question to you, the point that he made, which you can elaborate a little bit more for us, about how, and this was really interesting to me hearing it this way, was how he said the entities, or the regimes, I should say, that are formalizing ties with Israel are breathing life into Israel to make sure that Israel is able to maintain itself, so to speak. Explain that a little bit more for us, if you can, what he was saying there.
Well, it's quite clear now, as Sayyid Nasrallah is saying, that what we have right now is an attempt to try to not revive, but to try to keep it alive. This entity, as he said, it is dying. It is in its final stages. It is breathing its last breath. But we have those countries that are normalizing ties. Just recently, right now, we're talking about the Persian Gulf Arab states like the Emirates. We're talking about Bahrain. What they're trying to do is put a little, like you said, put life into the Zionist entity, because they need the Zionist project to stay alive, because they also believe that this would probably project on their own kingdoms and will probably also keep them in power as well, because as long as they support it, they have the support of the U.S. and so on. But you have the greatest power in the world up until now. The U.S. is still not able to protect Israel, so therefore nothing can protect them as well.
Sure. Final question here, Laith Maruf. Three threats that Hezbollah's Secretary General mentioned, and I'm reading it off. He said, based on how he said it, nuclear Iran, the entire alliance of the resistance as a whole, like the UAVs and the rockets that he said, and also the social internal crisis within the Israeli entity. So rounding those up, the other two, I asked you about one of them. Do you think, therefore, then, as Hezbollah's Secretary General said, that Israel really is on its last legs?
Definitely it is on its last legs. And when we heard the clear indications that Sayyid Nasrallah presented of the failures even of the battle between the wars, as the Zionists call it, the fact that right now the resistance in Lebanon doesn't need to transfer any of advanced missiles or drones to the country because it already has enough sufficiency in what it turned, upgraded of the missiles that it had and through the manufacturing that it has, which means that the battle that is in Syria is irrelevant for, and what the Zionists are doing is really actually attacking the Syrian state and the Syrian military and not any Hezbollah assets or transfer of information or equipment to Lebanon from Iran, which opens the door through his threats in terms of using the air defenses here, and who knows what Syria is preparing for, and the threat that that he referred to of a Israeli possible special forces operation in Lebanon to attack some of the warehouses of this military equipment that Hezbollah has, and how this could that actually Hezbollah is ready for such an attack and is going to use that to deliver a huge defeat on the Israeli invaders if they actually land here. And this is probably in reference to a operation that is not been discussed on air anywhere 2 weeks ago. Two Israeli special forces teams attempted a landing north of Beirut, and the information is still not been shared everywhere, but this is a hint from Sayyid Nasrallah that they could have turned it into a massacre for these invading forces, and it's a warning to the Israelis not to try something like this.
Thank you for that. I'm going to look that up, what you just said, since I didn't have any information on that either. Thank you so much. Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Also from Beirut, Mariam Saleh, a correspondent. Thank you so much, Mariam. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. A number of British, Muslim, and teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan Horse affair rocked Britain back in the year 2014, and it led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate which affects ordinary British Muslims today. Rob Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to the victims of what's now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalise schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts. But this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the former Brexit minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom. In another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent, Peter Walker. The piece is titled, David Frost Joins Tory MPs in Calling for Return of Fracking in UK. In Britain, the former Brexit minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom, in another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. Lord Frost argued that extracting domestic shale gas would give the UK a competitive and reliable source of energy. But Zach Goldsmith, a key Green voice within the government, said it would not reduce energy prices and would put ministers at war with furious communities. The letter to the Prime Minister was organised by the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group of Conservative MPs, which argues against many green levies and targets, saying the government should prioritise lower energy costs and more secure supplies. Last week, leading climate scientists told The Guardian that the group appeared to be trying to delay a shift towards lower emissions by including climate policies in a cultural war and spreading disinformation, a charge that the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group rejects. The MP's letter, shared with the Sunday Telegraph, said shale gas deposits around Lancashire and surrounding counties offer at least 50 years of cheap and sustainable gas. It read, "If levelling up is to mean anything, it must be centred around empowering communities rather than telling them what they can and cannot do. With a lack of public debate about our strategy to reach net zero emissions, we have abandoned this fundamental conservative principle. It's time to reverse this moratorium." The Sunday Telegraph said 29 MPs had signed the letter, but named only five of them. Craig McKinley, Steve Baker, John Whittingdale, Bob Blackman and Julian Knight. The organisers of the letter declined to reveal any more names. The former Brexit minister David Frost, who has emerged as a leading dissident voice on the Tory right since resigning from his ministerial role in December, told The Telegraph that fracking would bring a competitive and reliable source of energy and reduce reliance on imports. But Zach Goldsmith, a Foreign Office minister and peer, said that to even replace half the gas the United Kingdom imports would require 6,000 fracking wells, with all the associated industrial equipment and endless movements of trucks ferrying toxic chemicals and wastewater to and from sites. It's hard to imagine communities across the United Kingdom being okay with that. In a series of tweets, Zach Goldsmith said fracking was deeply unpopular with the British public, and that since any shale gas extracted would be sold at international market prices, it would have no impact on UK energy bills. Gas was still needed, he said, but added, "To have any impact at all, government would need to rig the market and go to war with furious communities. On every level, the cost would be enormous." The former Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, who offered fracking companies generous tax breaks in his 2013 budget before drilling licences were later revoked, told the House of Lords committee that extra gas production would only increase employment. George Osborne said fracked gas would be a small proportion of global production and would therefore have little influence on the international prices that dictate what the UK households pay. The government's position remains that fracking is unproven as a resource in the United Kingdom and that the inability to accurately predict earth tremors associated with it meant it could not be supported. The Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group is campaigning alongside Cordrilla, the company that operated two shale wells in Lancashire. Work at these were stopped in late 2019. When the government halted fracking in England after warnings about possible earthquakes. On Thursday, 10th of February, Cordrilla announced it was plugging and abandoning its two shale wells at the Preston New Road site in Preston, Lancashire, under instructions of the government's Oil and Gas Authority. News of this was announced in a joint press release between Cordrilla and the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group, NZSG, including quotes from the group's chair and vice-chair, Tory MPs Craig McKinley and Steve Baker, calling the decision utter madness. Similarly, the Telegraph article about the conservative net zero scrutiny group's letter was published alongside a comment piece from the chief executive of Cordrilla, Francis Egan, calling domestic fracking a no-brainer.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yani?
Bazaar. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries, and continents. They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings, and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar with me, Sarah Dema. In this episode, we're going to talk about the vast world of Iwan's wire and cable productions. We wanted to see who makes these items and why they are so important to numerous industries across the country. Plus, we will check out some of this industry's contributions to the national economy. So get comfortable and let's start the show. To become more familiar with wire production, we visited Behta Padideh Alborz. It began its activity 5 years ago in the field of production and distribution of wires and cables.
This company makes dozens of different types of wires and cables. Some are used in telecommunications, construction, electrical appliances, and automobile manufacturing. It also makes more complicated cables, such as coaxial cables. This type has an inner conductor surrounded by an insulating layer that is covered by conductive shielding. Currently, its production facilities have the capacity to make millions of meters of cables each month. Some 40 people work directly at this company, and 200 others are indirectly employed. It manufactures cables through a process of pulling either copper or aluminum cords. Advanced machines are used to stretch the metal conductors to the desired width. After this, depending on the use, the strands are either braided together or aligned and prepared for insulation covering. It is worth mentioning that this company has been producing wires and cables that were previously imported. Its productions have gained a significant share of the domestic market, too. Such domestic productions have prevented large amounts of capital flight throughout the years.
It might be interesting to know that 95% of raw materials needed to produce wires and cable can be domestically supplied. Because Iran is rich with natural resources, raw materials such as copper, aluminum, and petrochemical products are easily accessible to this industry. There is a small number of items that still need to be imported, such as sheath required for aluminum cables.
One of the advantages of this company is its diverse product range. It also has the capability of producing special types of cables to meet specific customer requirements that may currently not exist in the country. Remarkably, a key competitive advantage of this company is its technical know-how and experience. This has helped it manufacture its production machines and equipment and localize this technology in the country. Using its own machines has other benefits too, such as being able to maintain and control the quality of their products. Quality issues are very important in the cable industry. This cable manufacturer follows stringent specifications for the quality and safety of its wires and cables. Products are checked in the quality control center for their performance as well as to match other standardizations necessary in the sector. It's important to have the highest quality because wires are meant to last for years and sometimes for decades. Therefore, this company uses the highest grade of raw material to produce its items. As part of its future goals, this company is adding new products to its portfolio, such as fiber optic cables. But that's not all. This manufacturer stands on the cusp of exporting its products and plans to expand its market reach to neighboring countries as well.
Generally speaking, the country's wire and cable industry has witnessed exponential advancements over the years and has been developed in line with modern technical knowledge. Based on statistics from the industry, Iran produces more than what is needed for domestic consumption, so export-oriented production is an important aspect to keep this industry thriving.
The National Wire and Cables Producers Association says over 80% of the country's needs are supplied domestically and productions compete in quality with global brands. But the association says that exports are negligible compared to the large production outputs. Moreover, it estimates that Iran has the potential to sell at least $600 million worth of goods to neighboring countries annually. Yet the value of current exports is less than $100 million. So why is this? It's because this sector is only working at 30% of its entire capacity as it faces several obstacles for expansion and development. Industry participants say they can work at full production load if many of these challenges are removed. Increased production can also lead to more exports. Some of these challenges include the supply of machinery. More often than not, business owners are forced to go through multiple intermediaries to get the equipment they need. Doing so is time-consuming and adds to their costs. Other issues revolve around export barriers such as Iran's tariff system. Industry analysts say this system has inflated the end price of local products, sapping the country's competitiveness and exportability. Manufacturers say strict government regulations have also led to many businesses foregoing the path of exports altogether.
The biggest consumers of wires and cables in the country are in the telecommunications sectors and electrical power industry. Electricity is the mother of all industries and is heavily dependent on wires and cables. Iran is capable of producing large amounts of electricity and fully supplies domestic needs. It exports electrical power too. This sector requires high voltage cables to be able to distribute electricity nationally and also internationally.
According to the Electricity Industry Syndicate, domestic firms already produce high-voltage power cables and are ready to export their goods and services to international markets. Previously, these cables were imported, but domestic production has reduced imports by 20%. As the country develops its manufacturing industries, it also creates an enormous demand for electricity. The national power grid has been expanded by 60,000 kilometers in the last 4 years to meet growing requirements. Consequently, manufacturers had to set up production to supply wires and cables to the electrical power industry. We looked at some figures from the National Power Generation Transmission and Distribution Company. Data showed around 80% of the production of wires and cables in Iran is supplied to the power industry alone. The remaining 20% are used in electrical appliance, automobile, and construction industries, among others. It can be said that wires and cables play an important role in the electrical and electronic industry. The increasing demand for power, light, and communication has kept demand high for wires and cables. This industry has so much potential, promising a bright future for further development and growth. Iran has many natural resources. Some are agricultural and some other are natural wonders enjoyed by tourists and locals alike. Still, other resources have to be extracted by mining. The mining industry is a very important component of the economic health of Iran, contributing billions in a given year. This modern industry is also heavily dependent on the discoveries and innovations made by knowledge-based companies. These firms are often pioneers of development, opening new horizons for industries while making industrial processes more efficient and less costly.
One of the biggest capacities of Iran is its rich natural resources. Yes, we are talking about mines. They have brought tremendous profits while creating numerous jobs. This week, we will look at the mining industry and some of its related traits. We also want to uncover how this industry continues to expand and who is helping with its development. So let's start the show.
There are thousands of mines in the country, but before extracting material and using it, samples first need to be taken to labs for analysis. We visited a knowledge-based company that specializes in testing mineral, soil, and water samples from mines. Zar Azma was first established in 2006 and was created because of a lack of such services inside the country. Previously, analyzing samples from mines was outsourced abroad, but now domestic sample analysis has never been as advanced as it is today. Using the latest technology, this company analyzes samples on an industrial scale with speed, precision, and high-quality testing. Most of the machines have been imported, as well as transferring the analysis know-how from other countries. It mainly provides services to the mining industry and some of its related trades. Samples are sent from mines nationwide to the advanced labs for titration. This is a common lab method of quantitative chemical analysis that determines the concentration of a substance. This massive facility has several departments, each dedicated to a specific activity and equipped with quality control processes. After crushing, samples are processed into liquids, either using high temperatures or alkaline melting. Then they are fed to high-tech machines for analysis. These machines provide a sample profile showing what materials and in what percentage are present. It's important to get a detailed survey of material in mining areas. The industry routinely collects samples to assist with decision-making. This data helps with exploration, resource estimation, grade control, or plant design and balances. Indigenizing sample analysis services have saved the country millions of dollars in outsourcing so far. This has also sped up many processes as the industry no longer has to wait months for analysis results. Typically, when a sale transaction of mining material is to take place, the sample profile must be presented. A profile shows some criteria, such as the purity and concentration of a material, revealing the quality of the batch. The results are also used to determine whether samples match up with international standardizations. This is important information used for exports and imports of mining material. This knowledge-based firm has labs in three other provinces, including the mining heartland of Kerman. Its test results are trusted by the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the National Environmental Protection Agency, Mining Investment Insurance Corporation, and the National Copper Industries Corporation, among many others. This knowledge-based company also collaborates with research and academic institutions. Some 200 people are employed at these labs directly, and nearly 500 others work indirectly for this company. One of the competitive advantages is its rapid and reliable mineral testing. Plus, its highly developed quality control methods is what keeps them relevant in the market. Nearly 75% of all samples in the country are analyzed at these high-tech labs at affordable costs. Also, it has helped develop and expand Iranian mining sectors through its dependable lab studies. As part of its future vision, this knowledge-based company hopes to launch laboratories in neighboring regions. It also welcomes mineral samples from abroad for analysis. Iran is one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Here is an interesting fact that there are 60 billion tons of mineral reserves in the country. Roughly 40 billion tons of that total are proven reserves, meaning they are mineable. Iron, coppers, zinc, aluminum, and other minerals are also extracted from 6,000 mines in the country. The mining sector has made big strides in recent years, but it is still developing. Figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency show last year over 400 million tons of minerals were extracted. Aside from metal materials, the country is rich in construction materials too. Gravel, decorative stones, marble, sand, and cement make up over 60% of the country's mineral reserves. The government has been developing production capacities through various programs while expanding the sector's exploration projects to this end. One of these plans is to revive idle mines. Out of 10,000 mines in the country, around 4,000 of them are idle. It's noteworthy, over the last 2 years, some 500 small-scale idle mines have been brought back to life. That's based on the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization. One of the benefits of the ongoing revival plan has been the rise in nationwide employment. Presently, well over 100,000 miners are at work in the sector.
You might find it interesting to know that Iran holds the largest zinc reserves. Plus, it has the 9th largest copper reserves and the 10th largest iron ore and uranium reserves. With 7% of global mineral reserves, the export of mineral products generates millions in foreign revenue annually. But export figures could be much higher if the raw material is developed further with added value.
Numerous industries use raw materials provided by the mining sector. In the first half of 2020 alone, Iran was credited for producing 50% of the world's sponge iron. The majority of iron is used in the domestic steel industry. Last year, the World Steel Association ranked Iran as the 10th largest steel maker in the world. Figures showed that last year, over 55 million tons of mineral products were exported. The value of these exports was nearly $8 billion. The organization estimates that this year's export values will be much higher.
We all know what it feels like to be sick. You feel sluggish, fatigued, or lose your appetite, and perhaps become more sensitive to pain and cold. Many times, people can treat themselves at home with self-care and homemade remedies. Other times, a trip to the doctor does the trick. But even then, some ailments require more advanced interventions for diagnosis and therapies provided by hospitals. This is where medical devices come in handy. The health sector is mainly dependent on the accuracy and zero failure of advanced medical technology to get the job done.
All right, everyone, it's time to take a break as I'm gonna take you out on the field to a company, but I won't tell you any further. Let's go check it out.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere. Stay with me. At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line. All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country. Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. I'll see you in the next edition. And until then, stay safe and bye-bye. We are almost out of time for this episode, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in this industry and its related trades. The wire and cable industry get most of its raw material from the mining sector, and copper productions have gone through the roof recently. Iran is self-sufficient in the production of copper cathode that is used to make wires. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, domestic production of copper cathode rose by 9% last year. As reported, nearly 200,000 tons of cathode were produced in 2021. That's close to the government goal, which aims to increase cathode output to roughly 230,000 tons in the coming years. Copper and aluminum are frequently used in wires because of their low resistance and excellent conductivity. Plus, these materials are relatively resistant to corrosion, which allows for various types of applications. Home appliance manufacturing was up nearly 10% last year, despite several challenges and restrictions on the growth of this sector. The Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade says home appliance manufacturing stood at 15 million sets last year. This registered a 78% increase in production compared to the year before. Ministry officials say the home appliance industry's infrastructure and capacities have developed in leaps and bounds over the last 5 years. Owing to this, the country is projected to become a major exporter of such products in the coming years. The government has increased support for domestic production to neutralize the impacts of the U.S. sanctions and diversify the economy away from oil revenues. The home appliance sector has been one of the pioneers in this regard as it witnesses significant progress. Dozens of electricity projects have been launched this year in Yazd province to bring areas in this region online with the power grid. Nearly 130 projects worth $4 million started in Yazd province. The developments fall into four categories. These include network construction, electricity supply to rural areas, repairing networks, and improving lighting for cities and villages. Yazd Electricity Distribution Company estimates over 100,000 meters of low and medium voltage pressure cables need to be installed for these projects. According to the distributor, the province has some 73,000 electricity subscribers, but almost 75% of power is used by industries. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in and see you next time on another edition of Bazaar.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.